Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of September. We talk about loneliness this hour of our program and how loneliness can endanger a person's physical and mental health. What happens in our brains when people feel isolated and rejected? Our guest says loneliness not only alters behavior, but loneliness is related to greater resistance to blood flow through your cardiovascular system. It leads to higher rises in morning levels of the stress hormone, altered gene expression in immune cells, poorer immune function, higher blood pressure, and an increased level of depression. We're going to talk about this. What makes people happy? And when we are deprived of that source of happiness, what happens to us? What about feeling lonely at any given moment and feeling lonely over a long period of time? And perhaps most importantly in our discussion, how do you break from the lonely heart? How do you go from being lonely to be a social being, to find meaning and connection? What are the solutions to loneliness? We talk about all of this with the author of a brand new book, Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. And our guest is president of the Association for Psychological Science and the Tiffany and Margaret Black Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. Center for Cognitive and Social Neuroscience. He's been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and we thank him very much for being with us. His name is Professor John Cassipio. Cassiopo. There we go. Cassiopo. Professor John Cassiopo. And thank you so much, Professor Cassiopo, for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah. What made you write a book about loneliness? It's an interesting topic.
We've been in a field called social neuroscience. It's the neural and hormonal mechanisms, the genetic mechanisms associated with structures that extend beyond the individual, dyads, groups, societies, cultures, and how that promotes human welfare and evolutionary success. In our studies, we decided to look at what happens in the absence of social connection with others. Just like you might look at, if you wanted to study a gene, you might look at what happens in the absence that gene. And we were really quite surprised by the profound effects of perceived social isolation or loneliness.
And how would you describe, if there is a difference here, the difference between being lonely and loneliness? Is one more
right.
long-term than the other?
Being alone can contribute to loneliness, but in fact, our research, others' research, has shown that the number of contacts is not really what predicts loneliness.
Mm.
People can be alone in a crowd. They can be alone in a family, estranged from their spouse or kids. The freshmen who have just moved to college are among a lot of individuals, but they often feel isolated their first quarter at college. The empty nesting parents often feel isolated, even though they have virtually the same number of contacts. So it's the quality of the relationships, not the quantity, that determines perceived isolation.
Mm-hmm. I remember that when I went away to college. I was so incredibly lonely. I just never thought. I thought I was this fiercely independent person, and I missed my family so much. It was terrible.
That's, in fact, something that we found. We tested the loneliness of incoming freshmen and found a very high level, higher than normal level. We tested a quarter later, about 10 weeks later, and things had sorted out. People had gone back to being, you know, fairly integrated and made new friends. Incoming freshmen often don't realize that. Colleges set up things like mixers. And, of course, I've been to one, you've been to one. You go and you see everybody else talking and think, I'm the only one who feels isolated.
Right, exactly.
But it sorts its way back out.
There's also kind of this existential dilemma about life, is that, you know, you're born alone and you die alone, and you really realize this when you have any kind of major surgery. There you are, and you've never been more alone in your life.
Exactly, exactly. That's one of the arguments we make in the book, is that being alone is dangerous in evolutionary context. We're a social species. We don't actually survive very well on our own. And certainly our genes don't have a high chance of perpetuation if we're trying to survive on our own, because our offspring are so dependent on us. And as you said, when we're born, again, we're completely dependent on others, and isolation is basically a death sentence.
You begin the book with this woman who responded to an email you sent out about research you were doing, and I'd like for you to respond to her. 56, been divorced for years. When she was with her husband, she told somebody she was lonely, and they said, but you're married. Right. She's learned the difference between being alone and lonely. She always feels lonely in a crowd, at work, in a family setting, and can almost be a physical sensation. Her doctors, she says, have called it depression, but there is a difference. What is that difference? And how could somebody feel lonely among friends and at work and in a crowd?
Yes, that woman's letter I thought was quite striking, only because she captured so many of the research findings we were discovering. The first question, how can you be lonely when you're married? On average, married individuals are less lonely than non-married. However, within marriages, people are sometimes quite isolated from spouse or family and feel very alone. As we increase the speed with which we're living, we have more and more social contacts, but they become more and more superficial as well. So the number of contacts, again, doesn't translate into feeling like one has meaningful connections with others. 20 years ago, there was a survey, a national survey done, in which the question was asked, how many confidants do you have? The most frequent response to that question was three. That question was asked again a couple years ago. The most frequent response was zero. Not that we have fewer social contacts, it's that we're living a more sped life. Both parents are working. We have children to take care of. And so we have lots of contacts, many of which can be superficial. So we find people who live alone, people who are not married, being not at all lonely, and we find married couples sometimes who do feel lonely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the distinction we find.
Mm-hmm.
You asked also about the difference between loneliness and depression. The depression is associated with dysphoria, sadness. It's also associated with lethargy, feeling listless, sleepy, fatigue, not wanting to do anything, and withdrawing from others. Loneliness is much sharper. It's a feeling of sadness, but it's also a feeling of threat, feeling of danger, feeling of fear of others, but wanting to connect with those others. So it's associated much more with the social context and has different physiological effects and effects that we've seen in brain imaging.
Mm-hmm.
More recently looked at longitudinally, what is the association between loneliness and depression? And what we find longitudinally is that the lonelier people are today, taking out the level of depression today, the lonelier they are today, the lonelier and the more depressed they will be a year from now.
There are also all kinds of physical consequences of being lonely. I was amazed by this, that loneliness alters your behavior. It also gives you less blood flow through your cardiovascular system. There are morning levels of stress hormone, poor immune function. Your body kind of unravels a little bit, doesn't it?
Yes. In fact, one of the early findings we had was that if you take young adults and you just look at them during a normal day, what we had done was we brought in young adults to a hospital. We had a ward there that we were testing them on. And we put them through a series of psychological stressors, mental arithmetic, speech stressors, and we found that lonely individuals showed higher vascular resistance not only during those stressors, but before the stressors ever started. So they're sitting there with greater resistance to blood flow. Other research has shown that that vascular resistance can contribute to elevated blood pressure. And in cross-sectional and longitudinal research, we found that loneliness contributes to elevation in blood pressure in older adults.
We're going to pause for just a moment and get him on a better phone line because we don't want to have to strain to hear, particularly when we're talking about loneliness. We want to feel a good connection with him, and so we'll call him back and get one. We're talking with the author of Loneliness, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. John Cacioppo is the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, past president of the Association for Psychological Science. And it's an interesting idea. People say frequently they're lonely, but what about short-term loneliness? What about long-term loneliness? What happens to the body during loneliness? And what's the answer to loneliness? What do you need to do to be able to make a social connection with the doctor, with what the doctor believes is an extremely important thing, that we're social human beings and we need to be social? Does it help to have a little conversation with people you meet during the course of a day? I think we have a better line for him now. Can you hear me better now?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Oh, much better. Much better. I figured while we're talking about loneliness, we need to be able to hear you. Yeah. I think it might be important. You mentioned young people that you had brought in. Are there certain age groups? I guess we tend to think of old people who have lost loved ones, who have lost friends who have died, that we tend to think about that group of the American population as perhaps being more lonely with good reason than younger people. Is that true?
As you go across ages, loneliness is fairly constant until very late life. As people age, they actually decrease the number of contacts. So that perception on our part of aging is correct. But what people are trimming when they get older are the obligatory relationships. They just don't think it's worth having that lunch that they don't enjoy but felt obligated to have. Mm. So their levels of loneliness don't increase until late life.
Mm-hmm. And what about young people? Is there more loneliness there than we would imagine?
It's about the same level. About 20 to 22% of Americans, around 60 million people, complain of high levels or frequent levels of loneliness. Surprisingly, we find loneliness higher in the morning than in the evening. Hmm. If you just look across the course of a day, we know that from beeping people 63 times randomly and then looking at what they said about their feelings of loneliness. Some people feel lonelier than others chronically, but we also see variations across the course of a day. And it's when they arise in the morning that we find the highest levels of loneliness on average. But then across the age range, it's about 20% of the individuals who complain of fairly high levels at any point in time of age.
And what happens if you are feeling lonely in the morning and you just sort of consciously, if you can do this consciously, decide that you're going to have, they may be brief encounters with all of the people you meet during the course of the day. You go grocery shopping, you take your dog for a walk, and you meet somebody else. You pick up your child at school and you talk to, or the bus driver drops them off and you talk to the bus driver and you talk to the waitress or waiter or whatever. Do those move you out of loneliness, those kinds of connections?
Well, see, you put your finger on a very important aspect. People can, I mean, one of the good stories about our research is that people are not destined to live lonely lives. They can control this, and it's exactly through the kind of process you talked about. It's through exerting executive control, looking for those positive events and responding to people, realizing that loneliness makes you feel threatened, and so you often take care of yourself or are worried about your own well-being. Think again of early life and early evolutionary life. It is a threatening circumstance. And so we respond in fairly negative ways, self-protective ways, egocentric ways to other people. When we beep people, like I said in that story, in that study where we tested them across the course of the day, we found lonely and non-lonely people to be in the same situation, virtually to have identical events occur. The frequency of uplifts, the frequency of the hassles during the day were comparable. But the uplifts were less uplifting to the lonely individuals, and the hassles were perceived as more severe. They were the same circumstances. So if one just reflects and kind of exerts executive control and looks for those positive events, you can actually start to climb your way out. But another aspect of our research and research of Roy Baumeister at Florida State is that loneliness, feeling disconnected from other people, impairs one's ability to self-regulate. It impairs executive functioning. So the very means of getting out of it is also one of the things that's damaged by feeling lonely.
Mm-hmm. And is it somehow connected, would you say, to our basic makeup? There are some of us, or maybe it's not basic makeup, it's something you learn. Some of us who are more outgoing, we're more extroverted. Some of us who are more introverted and perhaps more prone to loneliness.
Right. So there is this notion that the more introverted you are, the lonelier you are. And we have found that's really not the case. There is a weak association between introversion and loneliness, but it's a very weak association. The difference really seems to be that an introvert might take one good quality relationship to feel connected to others, whereas an extrovert might take two or three. So it's translated into what makes a satisfying social context for an individual. Hmm. But we also looked at whether loneliness is heritable. And we found in collaboration with Dorette Boomsma, who's the director of the Netherlands Twin Register, we found that loneliness is about 50% heritable and about 50% situational or environmental.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. We have one line open if you'd like to join the conversation. Our guest is the author of Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. Professor John Cacioppo is with us, and he is the author of this book and the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, past president of the Association for Psychological Science. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now for our guest. Let's start with Laura from Madison. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guest about avoidant personality disorder. It's a disorder that characterized by extreme loneliness and desire to be with people, yet a fear, a mortification of being ridiculed or rejected by people, and so avoidant behaviors develop. And I'm just wondering, is this something that the doctor writes about? Is this something that he knows of any current treatment modality?
Yes, we have studied what are called population-based samples. We have randomly drawn people from the geographical vicinity to study so that we could generalize to people writ large, the same kind of sampling procedure that are used by political polling units. So we haven't studied the avoidant personality disorder that she described. However, I will say that when we look across the normal range of loneliness, those who feel intensely lonely do exactly what you described, and that is they tend to withdraw. They want to have contact with other individuals, but they expect negative evaluations. It also means that when they see someone do something that's ambiguous or unkind, they over-attribute. That is, they see it as a confirmation of the rejection that they knew was forthcoming. And, you know, they engage in self-protective behavior. They don't want to be hurt by anyone. None of us do. So normal individuals who are feeling lonely start to engage in self-protective behavior, which, of course, is paradoxically self-defeating. So it's very, very similar, not quite as extreme as the syndrome that you described, but very similar, just along the continuum, backed off just a little bit. And that's one of the problems. How people fall into chronic loneliness is that by withdrawing from others, they in fact make their isolation more real. And by expecting that pain and that rejection by others, they interpret slights in a way that confirms what it was that they feared most.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the book about loneliness often leading to aloof, demanding, or critical behavior, most likely to drive others away. Diminishing our ability to size up other people and accurately read their intentions. Why would it lead to critical behavior most likely to drive people away from us?
That's one of the paradoxical features of loneliness. It's associated with feeling threatened and trying to protect oneself. Hmm. You know, we don't treat ourselves well all the time, and so it's not to be expected that we treat our friends or associates well all the time. A lonely individual is particularly sensitive and wants to avoid that, and so anything that hints of that is interpreted in a fashion that confirms. So they respond a little more negatively to such things, and that makes them appear aloof and critical. There's a study done about a decade ago that's really kind of telling. It was a study where there was a subject and a confederate of the experimenter, but the subject didn't know that. The subject was either lonely or not. And the game was called Prisoner's Dilemma. Basically, what this means is that if two people cooperate, both win. If two people compete, both lose. If you cooperate but your partner defects, the partner wins big and vice versa. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And the game was set up so that the confederate, the other person, did whatever the subject did on the prior trial. So we have a lonely or non-lonely individual who's the subject completely determining what happens across the course of the game because their partner is just doing what they did on the prior trial.
Huh.
People never realize this. Kind of one of those anomalies. We don't realize the rule that's being used. And what was found was non-lonely individuals started out cooperating, and after you know, 10 trials or so, they defect, and then, of course, their partner defected. And then they'd cooperate, and they defect, and they cooperate. And across the series, they primarily cooperated. The lonely started out cooperating. They defected at about the same number of trials as the non-lonely. The difference was what happened after that. They defected, their partner defected, confirming what they feared, so they spiraled down into a series of defections. Hmm. At the end of that game, the lonely subjects thought they had no control over it, it wasn't their fault, and of course, they were the total architect of their social reality. So that's what we're talking about. Now, I'm not blaming lonely individuals, but if we understand that, then it also puts the ability to control that loneliness and work their way out of it in their hands.
Yeah, fascinating. Victor from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. Question. Is there a line to be drawn between a person who enjoys their solitude versus somebody being lonely? The other point I'd like to make is this is more situational. I believe Laura, first caller, touched upon this, but what about individuals who choose loneliness because they may be involved in what you call a toxic relationship? They've probably been through a physical abuse, emotional, mental abuse. It could have happened in their childhood. It could be happening in a marriage or some domestic relationship. Does your book cover those subjects? But personally, yes. Me, I consider myself solitary. Now, I have a healthy relationship with what I call close friends, but if you put me in a mountain retreat or a desert island, as long as I have my provisions, food, fresh water, some books to read, radio, I'll function just fine.
Right. Now, that's a very good point. And again, this is the distinction I was trying to draw earlier between introverts and extroverts, or people for whatever reason, some choose solitude. Some choose to be alone, but this is another reason why being alone doesn't mean you're lonely, and being with others doesn't mean you are not lonely. Lonely is the pain of feeling isolated. And so if you are blissfully in solitude, that's not loneliness. That's being alone, but that's not loneliness. Part of our harried lives today places us in a position where we want and need some time alone, just to decompress from all the demands that other people can make. That doesn't mean one is lonely by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, part of what the high speed of life today does is we don't have connections when we're with others, and we don't have connections when we're not with others. And so we try to connect electronically, which is only partly satisfying. So that's the first part of your question, I believe. The second part was about whether you can choose to be lonely, that is, to be in solitude and feel isolated and feel some pain, but prefer that over contact with others. And the answer is absolutely. The reasons one can find themselves lonely, as I said, is about half heritable, and it's not that you inherit being lonely. What you inherit is a sensitivity to being isolated, right? A sensitivity to feeling disconnected. And so some people feel that more sharply than others. If the alternative in your mind is worse than being with others, then indeed people can choose to be isolated. Part of what we're suggesting is one can and should get out of toxic relationships. Lonely individuals, in fact, we find are more likely to remain in those relationships because the alternative in their eyes of being without someone is worse than being with someone caustic. So, you know, we don't advocate staying in toxic relationships, but that's not the alternative. And in fact, you yourself described an alternative, and that is, you know, having contact with a few important friends can do wonders. Marriage is not the only way to be connected to other individuals.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting, and maybe this is one of the reasons I chose radio, but it seems to me as though this particular medium, I don't know if it can alleviate loneliness, but Victor brought up the fact that if he has a radio, and there's something about radio when it's well done, when it connects with other human beings, that I think can alleviate loneliness in a way that other mediums can't.
I think that if you look at people who walk down a cycle, you'll see them walking in different speeds. When they walk together, you see them synchronize. Right. All of a sudden, they go. They start mimicking not only pace but also movements. There's research that shows if you cross your legs and tap your foot, the other individual, without any awareness, will start mimicking. Not doing exactly, but they start to fall into physical resonance.
Hmm.
In experimental studies, if you vary whether you are physically resonant, synchronize yourself with the other person, and you do it subtly, the other person doesn't realize it. Their feeling of rapport and their liking of you increases with that resonance.
Hmm.
Now, if you think about the automated telephone services that we sometimes hear, the computer-generated
services. Oh, they drive you crazy.
Exactly. Now, if radio were like that, it would drive us all nuts because there's not the normal prosody or resonance of tone. I mean, the speech carries many of those same temporal and emotional prosodic features, right? So good radio allows you to get into that relationship with your imagination. You imagine the other person, and you fall into the same kind of synchrony as if you were walking together. What computer-generated speech and just online text doesn't allow is that kind of nonverbal, non-conscious connection between individuals.
Thank you, Victor, so much for your call. Let's go to Mary from Wood County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. This is really a very interesting discussion. I've found, I'm not a lonely person, but my family is 1,000 miles away. And I find one good way to avoid being lonely is to go out and try to cure somebody else's loneliness.
Hmm.
So, frequent telephone calls to your family. If you can't see them in person, the phone really is, your voice is nice. Or even just other people, you call them up and say, I was just thinking of you and, how you doing? And if they want to talk to you, fine, or if they don't. Because I have a brother who I think qualifies as very lonely. He has a hard time making connections. Well, you have to keep working at that.
Right.
You just have to keep, or other people that, that you can tell they're having a hard time connecting. If you keep working at it, eventually you get results.
Right. That's actually excellent. One of the findings that we had in our study of incoming freshmen was their level of loneliness was directly related to how many miles from home the university was. The more miles from home, the lonelier our freshmen were. Which is very much like you were talking about with your family and friends. Phones are constant. I mean, that can be done in any case, but there is a sense in which if they're 1,000 miles away, they are less available if something comes up than if they're closer by. But you also said something very, very on target, and that is that to reconnect with others, helping someone else is remarkably effective, and it's remarkably effective for a couple of reasons. One is that, remember, loneliness is associated with a withdrawal and a feeling of threat. But when you help others, you're now in contact with others, and you're doing so in a safe fashion, in a safe environment. Lonely individuals often expect pain, rejection. When you're helping others, you find out that people are remarkably positive, they're remarkably reciprocal, they're grateful. Lonely people hunger for social contact. That means oftentimes when they interact, they want to eat the other person, and that's not pleasant for anybody. Right? Well, when you help others, you're feeding others, right? And you're eating with them. You're cooking a meal, you're eating together with them, and that's really what good social relationships are about. So that's actually a superb early remedy for someone who's lonely. That's a piece of advice we often give, and that is to go out and do community service. Engage in some activity that gives to others in a fashion that interests you as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. We're talking this hour on the Ideas Network with the author of Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. Professor John Cacioppo is our guest, and we are welcoming phone calls. Some lines are open if you've been trying to get through. You could do so right now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or send an email if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Can you talk about, please, the early days of our time on Earth when we need this human bonding experience? How important is that to feel that connection, be it with mom or be it with dad, who's taking care of our every need and has to? Describe that bond and how it may or may not have lifelong ramifications.
Well, indeed, the early connection that one forms with parents, whether it's a secure or insecure attachment, can have long shadows across one's life. An early caller mentioned an abusive early childhood can set one to be wary of others for a long period of their life. Now, fortunately, the research has shown that, except in extraordinary cases, that if one is fortunate enough to form good friendships, to fall into a trustworthy relationship with someone, one can overcome those early traumas. But it does set one on a course of being a little wary and less secure in the attachments that they form. But it doesn't destine one to that kind of outcome. But we are, you know, when we're first born, we're totally dependent. Humans have the longest period of abject dependency of any species. We are totally dependent on caretakers for our very own survival. And those caretakers, their genetic heritage isn't their ability to reproduce. This is one of the differences between humans and many other species. There's a handful of species with long periods of abject dependency. We have the longest. But it's not that parents' ability to reproduce. It's the ability of their offspring to survive, to reproduce, that makes that determines whether their genes make it into the gene pool. Mm-hmm. And so that places a dual pressure on some signal, like loneliness, that's a pain signal that helps ensure our genetic survival, and that is that forces us to try to remedy that by connecting with other individuals.
Sky is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Sky.
Hi. Not to diminish anything the speaker has said, I would like to talk about the positive values of loneliness from a spiritual, philosophical point of view. Someone said that 90% of our problems in the world come from people not being able to sit in a room by themselves. Mark Twain said that if you can't stand being by yourself, perhaps you bore other people too. And I think loneliness is the essential condition of people. We're all in this alone, some wag said. We die alone, we're born alone. And coming to terms with loneliness is, and your fundamental isolation is good in the sense that we're driven deeper into ourselves. And also, there's a kind of spiritual longing that's not satisfied by any number of human relationships. And that's very mysterious to me, but all the great teachers, I think, say that we're not going to be happy ultimately until we're bonded with the great, I call it the great whatever. I don't know what it is, but there's that spiritual longing, that dimension. So those are just a couple of comments, and I have a question, whether there's gender differences in this loneliness thing. It seems to me that there is, but I'd like to hear it.
Well, there's three questions I believe you asked. Let me comment on each, and I'll go in reverse order. The gender differences. We find very similar effects of loneliness on men and women. We find the mental structure of the concept of loneliness, which is a quantitative construct that psychologists work with, but that structure in the minds of men and women is the same, but the weighting of the factors is different. So let me unpack that statement a little bit. Men and women both find in relationships an affirmation of who they are, and this is the kind of self-insight that you were alluding to that loneliness can actually promote. And I agree with you, but I'll come back to how that happens. And others affirm who you are. So loneliness turns out to undermine self-esteem as well, because others who reject you question your very self-concept. Okay? The second is all face-to-face relationships. We call it relational connectedness or relational isolation. All face-to-face relationships. Friends and family are the best predictor of that construct. The third is collective connectedness or collective isolation. And this is our social identity, being a male, being a professor, being an American. Immediately after 9/11, as tragic as that was, the media noted how there was a sense of cohesion and harmony in the U.S. that was relatively unusual. And unfortunately, that period was time-limited. We've kind of gone back to how we were previously, but that sense of coherence, cohesiveness, and harmony is what one would expect when a social identity is made very, very salient. So those three aspects are important for men and women. However, for women, relational connectedness is weighted more than the collective, and vice versa for men. In everyday parlance, you see this in terms of men not understanding women's needs. need for girlfriends. You know, it's a little hard sometimes for a guy to fathom. Why are girlfriends so important? But if you talk to most women, they'll say, oh, girlfriends are really important to me. On the other hand, women might look at a husband on a Sunday by themselves in front of their TV rooting for a team, you know, the Tribe or the Cubs, whoever their favorite team might be, the Packers. And the woman will look at that and say, he's such a nice lad. He's sitting there all by himself. And the man sitting there going, I'm with my tribe. You know, I'm not alone at all. So there's that gender difference in exactly what it takes to feel connected. And again, it's a matter of amount, not qualitatively different. So that's the one gender difference that we do see. Your mention of loneliness having a productive role, I agree. It can, in fact, lead to self-reflection, self-insight. And I make it very similar to hunger. If hunger is a pain cue that signals you that your blood sugar is dropping and you need to find food to restore your energy resources. Loneliness is a signal that something's wrong. You're not connected with others, and you need to reconnect to others in order to protect yourself in an evolutionary and, in fact, in a contemporary fashion. Both of those are pain signals that serve a purpose. That doesn't mean dieting or fasting isn't good for the body. But if you do it too much, if you not only fast but then live a life of undernourishment, that can be damaging to the body. And I would say the same is true about loneliness. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say thank you to Sky, but go ahead.
The last is, he mentioned how loneliness is associated with spirituality or philosophical.
Yes.
That's actually something we have, well, I know that religious literature, in many different religions, going off by yourself was a means of a practice in which one used to find God. And we questioned what exactly is involved in that, and is our research relevant? And what it led to was a theory of anthropomorphism. What we find is, if we isolate individuals, if we make them feel lonely, their belief in God increases. Now, we've randomly assigned people to feel lonely or not. Their belief in God increases. I took the Hubble telescope photos that I use for my screensaver. We put them on cardstock. A colleague and graduate student took them downtown in Chicago to people sitting in Grants Park, our big park area downtown,
sure.
And walked up to people and gave them these pictures and said, they're pictures of supernovas and galaxies, and asked, to what extent does this celestial body have a theory of mind? Right? To what extent does it have volition versus to what extent is it active? So the active is not a human feature, but it's something you would say about any celestial body. These others were uniquely human attributes. And then we asked them three questions that allowed us to measure their loneliness. The lonelier they were, the more they anthropomorphized those celestial bodies. If we experimentally manipulate loneliness, we get the same thing. So one of the reasons isolating yourself, that religious practice may work, is that you need to connect. We need to connect. And if we don't have individuals with whom to connect, we connect with other features. Now, whether these are actual connections or these are beliefs and connections, you know, a scientist isn't able to say. I will say, though, that whether it's gadgets that we construct, pets, celestial bodies, or God, we see exactly the same time, a type of attempt to connect.
More phone calls in just one moment. The author of Loneliness is with us this hour, Human Nature and the Need for Social Connection. Thanks, Sky, for the call, and we'll take more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls now. Randy from Lavelle. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Yeah, listen, I have a question that's related to intensity or time, as it might relate to the notion of loneliness or overcoming that in the life of people, like in families. Have four children, all got spread out all over the place, and found myself traveling long distances to see them just a very brief period of time. later, people would question, or we always were adding up, boy, that's expensive. Is that wise to do, to just see them such a brief period of time? But later, as we would sit around, they would say, oh, boy, that sure was a good visit. And I would think, you know, what did I do? I did go there and wanted to and saw you and maybe answered a question or you were going through this or that and we did talk this or that over. And I found those brief visits, you know, sometimes drive 2 days to see your child or whatever. And I've found that that's been very, very productive. And the child would, young adult child, would feel a great sense of overcoming what could have been a lonely time in their life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is there some, and yet such a brief period of time, you might spend with them only maybe an hour or two.
Right.
Not days or not a whole vacation or, you know, there's this theory that take a vacation with your family, you know, and of course that would be nice. But having four children, which in retrospect, the energy that's taken to do, I wonder if I would have done that as a young man. I might have said, you know, have one or two, but four got to be quite demanding there.
Quality is important.
I think that's brilliant. Your point is that it's the quality. One can imagine being smothered by one's parents visiting, or us smothering our kids by the visits, and that wouldn't promote connection. But having threads of connection woven carefully can make for a very strong connective tissue. My daughter currently is in Africa, serving as a reporter for a magazine there, and she was robbed of everything. Her hotel, she was in fact in the room asleep.
Oh my.
Everything was stolen. Everything. Passport, money, computer, phone, everything. And, you know, I had not been in frequent contact with her, nor did she want me to be. But when that happened, as you can imagine, I was in very frequent contact with her and kind of helped her get through that dire period. She's fine now. Everything's resolved. But that was a period, just as you're suggesting, there are certain moments, if you were there for them, that makes for all the contact that you need for very high quality relationships with your children or with others. And now that she's fine, she's currently on her way to Kilimanjaro to try to climb Kilimanjaro. I don't know where she got her adventure.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
But she's doing fine again. If I had not been in touch during that period, she would have had a much more difficult time. So your point's really quite well taken. It isn't the quantity. In fact, quantity can be seen as smothering an individual. It's appropriately timed contact or frequent inquiries, but just brief inquiries so that when they do have an issue, that you're there for them. That turns out to be the quality aspect of relationships that make them truly meaningful and rewarding.
Thanks, Randy, for your call. Mark from Racine is next. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I've got a question, comment. I personally am autistic. I was raised in the 50s when people who clearly had capabilities but weren't living up to them needed to be punished. And essentially, I cannot occupy the same set of assumptions as the rest of the world. I'm part of sort of a subset of humanity. And I find relatively few people that I can really relate to well. A lot of the affiliative things that people use is, really faith-based tribal things like sports and politics and stuff. I'm really skeptical of all that stuff. So anyhow, I find myself actually lonelier out amongst people when they basically hold and express belief systems I can't reply with endorsement to, and they certainly can't endorse my belief systems. I have a few friends, but they too are isolated, and one of them I think is likely to die this coming winter as a result of basically loneliness and seasonal affective disorder. I was wondering if you would have any recommendations.
That's difficult. May I ask you a question or two?
Sure.
When you say that you have a few friends, are these? Do you enjoy the time best with them in physical contact or through technology? How did you enjoy connecting best?
Well, being with them, talking and stuff, we're all sort of technical, geeky guys, uh-huh. and we can talk more or less on a plane. But the thing is, we just find ourselves more or less isolated. I'm autistic. One of these guys is a bipolar. Another guy is a guy who builds analog synthesizers for a living, and his kind of market is drying up. But we basically were people who were out on the rim of the bell curve, and there's few people in our little slice. In any given location.
There is research by Ralph Adolphs at Caltech looking at individuals with autistic syndrome and found that eye contact was uncomfortable. Is that something you experience or not?
Yeah.
Okay. I raised that question because you said something earlier that I think is worth echoing, and that's that different individuals have different preferences for how they like to relate.
Mm-hmm.
And what's key is to find others who relate in the same fashion. And it goes back to the comment I made earlier about people who, when they walk together, they fall into resonance, and the extent to which one shows resonance creates rapport and liking for the other individual.
Mm-hmm.
At least based on Ralph's work and on your comment, people with autistic disorders have a different preference for how they relate to other individuals, and there's nothing wrong with how one chooses to relate or finds
relate.
The key is to match, to find other individuals who relate in the same fashion, and it sounds like that's what you've succeeded in doing.
Mm-hmm.
Your friend is a different case, and I will say that if there's serious depression, loneliness and depression are related. Loneliness promotes depression.
Sure.
But there are cases, and we say this in the book, where one may well need medical intervention. And so if your friend is seriously depressed, you might encourage that kind of attention and intervention.
Well, the thing is, he has no insurance, and medical intervention is very expensive. And he doesn't get out of his house very much. And can't really afford medical intervention. I've gotten some friends actually into VA care because they had been formerly in the service. One of them was homeless, another one was about to become homeless. But the thing is, if there aren't resources for those people, it's not available. And to a certain extent, I guess, I think when the crisis comes, I'm going to offer to intervene, but mm-hmm. ultimately, it's his decision.
Right. Right.
Well,
I wish you luck with that. Connecting with them is important.
And ultimately, everybody should be able to have some care, too.
Right.
And you made that point quite dramatically. Thanks very much for the call. Tim, we have about a minute and a half left from Oshkosh. Hi, Tim.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a recent college graduate, and during school I had a roommate and knew several other people who would retreat to computer and video games because that's where they found easy companionship. But when they were placed in the real world, they didn't know how to operate and were terribly lonely people despite their online, I put that quote-unquote online, friends.
Right.
And this really prevented them from finding meaningful relationships outside. I even had a friend who was literally dumped in the middle of a date because she was brutally honest and said, you don't have any self-confidence in yourself. Did you do any research concerning the technological age that we live in now and concerning that? I'll take that off air.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Yes. Briefly, we have looked at that research, and it shows an interesting pattern. If the connections through technology take away one connection that they make face-to-face, loneliness increases and depression increases. If, on the other hand, one is stigmatized or isolated, perhaps due to disability, and they're not able to get out, then connection through technology, as thin-stranded as it so loneliness and depression go down. So it really depends on one's level. But it so far has not replaced, due to this kind of non-conscious connection, it hasn't replaced face-to-face. But it can benefit, or as you suggest, quite accurately, when it detracts from social engagement, it actually has deleterious effects.
And thanks so much for the call. We thank you for the book and a very interesting conversation. Reached a good audience today. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Professor John Cacioppo is the author of Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. He's the Tiffany and Margaret Blake Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago and past president of the Association for Psychological Science. And the book is Loneliness, Human Nature, and the Need for Social Connection. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Katie Madsen for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow. We'll be looking at one of the major presidential issues, which is the economy and jobs. And we'll also be talking with Steven Pinker tomorrow. His latest book is The Stuff of Thought: Language is a Window into Human Nature. So that's coming up tomorrow. And a lot coming up the remaining hours of today on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.